Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your New Comics Wednesday episode for August 26th, 2020.
And I'm Manny.
And we're going to give you a spoiler-free look at some of the books that came out today and some other titles that you might want to be on the lookout for. Actually, this is one of those times where I think I read more comics than I'm actually going to talk about, which is kind of weird because it just so happens. This doesn't necessarily happen that often, but Manny and I kind of read a lot of the same titles this week, which doesn't always happen that way. So let me go ahead and kick it off, because I think you only have five books to talk about, Manny, and I actually have you have four, and I think I have five.
Jesus. Okay.
Yeah, so I'm going to start with Fantastic Four Antithesis number one. I didn't really know much about this book going into it other than Neil Adams was involved. So he's actually doing the story. He's listed as a storyteller along with Mark Waid. So I don't know how much of the plot he's involved in fleshing out. But as I said, he's listed as a storyteller. So clearly he's doing the art. Mark Farmer is on inks. We've got Laura Martin on colors, and letters are by Joe Caramagna. And the first thing that I noticed, and in the interest of full disclosure, for whatever reason, the Marvel previews copies I got, the art, it's not as bad on this one, except on the cover. It's kind of blurry. But on the other Marvel book that I'm going to talk about, the whole book is blurry, and so it makes it a little tough to really judge the art. But that being said, I don't think that, and I don't know if it's his style of art or if his style has changed over time. I mean, maybe his Neil Adams art used to be kind of more innovative back in the day, and so it read a little better. But his art has not. It's either I'm tired of the style, or it hasn't held up in quality over the years. And it's a little bit of both, you know. And I don't mean to disparage anybody. I mean, Neil Adams is kind of a jerk, to hear a lot of people say it. But nobody's going to maintain their level of quality forever, you know, and the guy's getting up there in age. So that's not to say the storytelling's bad, because I think the storytelling is still pretty good, and I think the art is still pretty good. But it's not legendary the way you used to think of Neil Adams' art being legendary. And I particularly don't care for the way that he draws The Thing. There's a couple times where it just looks plain bad. I'll share my screen with you, Manny, so you can see what I'm talking about. Like this like pulled me out of the story. It was so bad. And that should never happen when you're reading a comic, in my opinion. So, but we'll see if you agree with me or not. So right here, like this, The Thing's mouth right here, that's just not good. That's not good. So as far as the story goes, I don't know. It's typical Fantastic Four stuff. Annihilus shows up. There's Negative Zone stuff. There's a lot of kind of classic Ben and Johnny back and forth. There's Reed's too preoccupied and doesn't pay enough attention to Sue. So there's nothing groundbreaking. And the comic, while not a bad comic, I wasn't even really interested in it till we got to like the last two pages, where another character shows up that I was like, oh, I didn't know he was in this. And then he kind of explains what's going on, and you're like, oh, well, that's something new and different that I hadn't seen before. And so that has me coming back for the next issue. So if that was Wade and Adam's plan all along, just to give us kind of a generic Fantastic Four issue for the first, you know, 18 pages, and then the last two pages throw a hook at us to get us to come back, then it worked on me. So again, the art's not terrible. I think the color work is outstanding, and I think the story's kind of okay. And I think Neil Adams, overall, he draws a pretty good Fantastic Four with the exception of the Thing. He shouldn't draw the Thing. He looks weird the way Adams draws him. Like, this doesn't look good. Like Adams draws him like a guy with rocks stuck on him rather than a guy made out of rocks, if that makes sense. So it doesn't really work for me. So anyway, yeah, it was okay. I would say if you're a big Neil Adams fan, pick it up. If you're a big Fantastic Four fan, pick it up. If not, and you're kind of on the fence, then flip through it. And when you get to those last couple pages, if that's something that interests you, then pick it up. If not, you can probably wait for the trade. And as I'm saying that, the character that shows up in the last couple pages, I'm looking at the cover. That character's there on the cover. So it's not that spoilery, because if you see the cover, you'll know the character that I'm talking about. So. All right, Manny, what do you have up first?
I have Suicide Squad number 8 by Tom Taylor, with art by Daniel Samper, and colors by Adriano Lucas. So we've gone as far as Ted Kord's the bad guy in this, and apparently for now, what it looks like is it's all about the big bucks. And it's all about the oil. And so now with Deadshot and his family escaping the grasp of Task Force X, this is kind of like I call it more of a filler issue than anything else, just because of the fact that it doesn't really provide too much. Nothing other than kind of a little bit of backstory on a couple of the characters, and that's really about it. And then it just kind of picks up from where the last issue picks up, where it's kind of letting you know what the deal is going to be going forward. The two characters that it focuses on is one of the younger characters with wings. Ari, which is always found weird. And then the other character, I think, is called Wink. Yeah. So it focuses on how they met and how he actually got his wings, and how they were being groomed kind of for Task Force X. But like I said, it's a filler issue, really. It doesn't really do much for me. I don't feel like it did much for the story, other than just to give me an origin story. And I mean, because it doesn't. I already knew Amanda Waller is an asshole, so when she came in and started harvesting some of these young kids that they're trying to, it's almost like they're in like a Harbinger Foundation where they're trying to. Find kids with powers and then groom them for whatever it is that they need. And so that's really it. I mean, I wish there was more to say, because if I talk about the ending, it really spoils the whole issue as far as the plot moving forward. Nothing special. I mean, the last issue, issue 7, I thought was so fantastic. Just because I'm a big fan of Deadshot, and despite the fact that he's a villain, he's so big when it comes to family, his daughter, and protecting them. And then I don't know, it was just this issue almost feels out of place, and we don't really need it. With that said, I mean with the beginning and the end, it does move the story along a little bit, but this whole going back to their origins, I'm kind of a little miffed as to why they felt it was important.
Yeah, all I can think of is they want to make you care about these characters a little more before they kick the bucket.
I want to know more about, like, Ted Kord. What's his deal? Like, so I'm more interested in that.
So I'm trying to find the where I saw it. I read today, I think it was on Twitter, that Tom Taylor came out and he showed the cover, I think, maybe for number 10, maybe it was. And he said something about... it actually was Comic Comic Book Resources did an article, and the article said Suicide Squad explains what broke Blue Beetle, and then Tom Taylor replied to that tweet saying, "You will find answers in issue 9 next month. Trust me." So we know in issue 9 that Deadshot supposedly gets killed. Like, that's on the cover. That's been what they've been building up to, and the cover is like a picture of his helmet with like a bullet hole right between the eyes. And yeah, and supposedly we find out what happened with Ted Kord next issue. So I'm not sure why they I haven't read Suicide Squad number 8 yet. But I'm not sure why they decided to give us the origins of these characters, other than, like I said, just kind of take a beat before the big issue 9 drops and to make us care more about these characters. Other than that,
it just seems out of place. We're so far along into the story now that it's like when you do like 10, like a whole season on Netflix or something, and then like there's like episode 7 or 8 right before the big climatic reveal, you learn about some of the characters' backstory, then you're like, oh, that character's probably gonna die, or just it's not like, if you take that information out, I don't feel like I lost much.
Yeah, but I do feel like King. I do feel like Tom Taylor had this plan the whole time, because we know that this was written as a, what is it, 11 issue series?
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that, or that it's
issue or whatever. So he always knew he was going to do this in this issue. But
no, I know. I'm not saying that they stuck it in at the last minute. I'm just saying it still just feels out of place.
Yeah, right on. Well, like I said, I haven't read it, so I can't really speak to that. But my next book is Canto, The Hollow Man. Canto 2, I guess. The Hollow Man. So Canto was a kind of an all ages book about this. It's not really a robot. I guess they're kind of like, what do they call? They're like clockwork machines. Clockwork Knight is what he's called. And he went on a quest in the first 4-issue series to rescue the heart of his beloved. So there's these clockwork people. They've been enslaved, and their hearts were removed, and they were replaced with clocks, and they were forced into like slave labor by this kind of evil sorcerer kind of guy. And if they didn't do what they were supposed to do, he would let their clock wind down and they would die. So and they were forbidden to like make friends or have names or love each other or any of that kind of stuff. They were just like automatons. And in Canto, one of the automatons kind of rebels against that, and he falls in love with this other clockwork girl, and he goes on this quest and tries to rescue them all, and that's sort of the first four. So it was really popular. It sort of came out of nowhere for IDW, and the first couple issues go for quite a bit. So we're back with the second volume. It's written by David M. Buher. The art is by Drew Zucker. Colors are by Vittorio Estone. And letters are by Darren Bennett. And there are various covers. There's one exclusive cover that is an homage to Amazing Spider-Man 300. And then there's a couple different Peach Momoko covers, which before San Diego Comic-Con this year, I had not heard of Peach Momoko as an artist. And, like, she's blowing up. Like, people are buying her stuff, and it goes, like, crazy on the secondary market. I don't really see the appeal. I'm like, whatever. Her art's not that great to me, but certain people do seem to love it. And then there are some incentive covers. One of the incentive covers looks like it's an homage to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, number one. So it's got the black frame, and everybody's in red in the middle, sort of in red tones. So it was kind of cool to see that. But anyway, this Canto 2, The Hollow Man, it sort of picks up where the first one left off. You know, Canto had freed his people, and now they're trying to, it's a matter of months have gone by, and now they're trying to live in peace and sort of establish a society. And throughout the course of the first issue, we see that things aren't quite as good in New Arcana as you would think. Just because they have their freedom doesn't mean they're going to live happily ever after. So it looks like it's up to Canto once again to save the day. But this time he's not alone. He's taking some of his friends with him. Well, actually, he's not taking them with him. His friends are insisting on joining him, and they don't want him to go alone. Despite him saying, no, I don't want you to risk yourselves, they join his quest as well. So it's got the same all-ages feel that the first one did. My 8-year-old daughter read the first four issue miniseries and loved them. It was something where I could just give them to her. I didn't have to explain anything to her. I didn't have to, you know, worry about any kind of language or, you know, inappropriate situations or anything like that. It's just a great all-ages comic. I enjoy reading it, but I can pass it off to her and she can check it out. The art is good. The colors are solid. So just all in all, a really fun book that you can share with your kids. Makes a great bedtime story, that sort of thing. So I did like it. Did you or your daughter read the first Canto, Manny?
Hmm.
Yeah, I think she'd really like it. You should check it out.
Yep, I will definitely be doing that.
All right, what do you have up next?
Oh, yeah, so next up I have Wonder Woman 761. And this one is written by Mariko Tamaki with pencils by Carlo Barberi, ink by Matt Santarelli, colors by Alejandro Sanchez. So far it's been a great story. Not too complex. Reintroduction of Maxwell Lord, as we've seen in the previous issues, and as we learned in the last issue, Wonder Woman thought she was fighting parademons, and it turns out she wasn't. And so in this issue, we learn more about that and some not so friendly alliances that she has to make. Very interesting on how that develops and what she has to, and you get to see her more, not necessarily physical strength, but her mental strength and how she's able to endure that. I will say that the one thing that kept kind of taking me out of this issue, and I know I texted you about this earlier, is inconsistent art. While the colors I think were done really well, and I think that it was inked really, really well, I think the pencils, the actual art of it, the design was a little off at times. I will direct you to the page where it has all of the creative team. How long is her neck? I mean, she just has a really long, I feel like her neck's not in proportion to what her face is and the rest of her body. And then if you go I think the next page or maybe two pages down where she's holding Etta's hands, again, the length of her neck is kind of startling. almost E.T. like, I think. and then the next panel, the next page where she's face to face with another character, again, look at the length of that neck. It's almost the same. It's
the bottom. Yeah, that's terrible. Yeah.
And the thing is, I feel like if you fix those little things, the art's not that bad. It's actually I like it. I like the way that Maxwell Lord, for example, drawn. The facial expressions are done really well. There's another panel a little bit later where, like, well, I guess it has to do a little bit more also the way it's colored and inked, but like you can even though like this is a thinner Wonder Woman, like you can see like the muscle tones, and I really like that. Like you can really see that she's like super fit. But and then you have that where it's like it's just weird, it's just off, and I thought I was like, well, I'm not crazy, right? Like I'm not the only one seeing these long necks, and so it got a little funky at some moments, but overall, definitely great story so far, and it really leaves you on an amazing cliffhanger.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting. We know that, like, since their run started, Tamaki and, Mikhail Yanin, that this 761 was going to introduce a new villain called Liar Liar. And then it leaked pretty early on that Liar Liar's actually first appearance is 759, the beginning of their run. The character Liar Liar shows up just as like a civilian person, and now this one it's revealed. So I kind of wish that that hadn't been leaked, because it is a pretty cool thing that we see right at the end. And the other part I like is we find out that Liar Liar has a connection to another character in the book, which could be super interesting. So yeah, I really like the story. Where I do feel like it's moving maybe a little slower than I would like, but I'm okay with that. I trust Tamaki. The art obviously was the big drawback. As much as I like this issue, the art was like right when we got to that page that you're talking about with the credits on it, I knew we were in trouble. I mean, when I got to the first page of the book and I saw it wasn't Mikel Yanin, mm-hmm. I was already disappointed. And I was like, wait a second, he was supposed to be. You know, they made a big deal about it's going to be Tamaki and Mikel Yanin, and now after only two issues, he's already gone. And so then I was trying to figure out where he went, and I couldn't find him in any solicits for anything in November except for a cover for Hawkman 26, I think it is. And then I was trying to figure it out, and I was kind of looking on Twitter, and I was thinking, I remember somebody that I talked to on a regular basis said something about him being off Wonder Woman already, and I was trying to remember who it was. And then throughout the course of my day, before I could research it, I saw Mikel Yanin retweet something that DC put out about, what is it? Is it fine? It's not Final Night, Everlasting Night, or Eternal Night, or no, Eternal Winter. Oh, okay. Eternal Winter, yeah. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. So the whatever their next event is called Eternal Winter, Mikel Yanin retweeted it. And normally he only retweets things that he's involved in. Yeah. And when I looked at it, like I looked at the picture that was accompanying it, it was clearly Mikel Yanin art, a redesign for different, like, I guess, winterized costume, you'd call it, for Batman, and same for Wonder Woman. So I think the reason he's not drawing Wonder Woman right now is he's probably working on Eternal Winter. So
That's a bad bait and switch, though. You know,
yeah, I agree with you.
Super excited.
I agree with you. But again, this decision was probably made for him to be on Wonder Woman. And then 2 months later, they said, oh, we want you on this. Because remember how long it takes this stuff to actually happen. So yeah. Hopefully he comes back to Wonder Woman. Or maybe we can get at least a few more issues of it. Because I do kind of agree. I mean, part of the reason I was in was him, was his art. And he's already gone. And yeah, and it's not just the neck thing. It's just her whole head sometimes. Sometimes it looks really
kind of
round and like a kid, right? Like when you draw young people, you tend to make their faces more roundish. It gives that impression of being young. And then later on, her face is longer, and that tends to make her look older. So it's really inconsistent. And that's not to say that Barbieri's art is bad. I think he just, you know, I haven't heard of him before. So I'm guessing he's relatively new. And I think he just needs a little more seasoning. Or, you know, throw him into Jim Lee's office, and Jim will whip him into shape in no time. I guarantee that. So, yeah, good issue. But, the art did hold it back a little bit. All right, what am I going to talk about next? Let's talk about the other Marvel book that I read this week. It's Daredevil Annual 1. It's written by Chip Zdarsky. The pencils are by Manuel Garcia. Inks by LeBou Underwood. There's also a flashback artist, which is Chris Mooneyham. And then we have Rochelle Rosenberg on colors and Clayton Cowell on letters. So in the interest of full disclosure, I am not like completely caught up on Daredevil, either the Mark Waid run or the Charles Soule run or the Chip Zdarsky run. I do know that there is a like Matt Murdock has a twin brother, like supposedly, which he never had before, but somehow he invented this persona of a twin brother called Mike Murdock and used it to like kind of go undercover. And then somehow that that fake person got brought to life, and so now there actually is a Mike Murdock in the Marvel Universe, I think. This is basically kind of his origin story, and it almost reads like a what if story, but it's an interesting alternate look at what would Matt Murdock's childhood have been like if he had a twin brother, how that would have changed things for him and for their dad and for Daredevil. So it's probably something you can read on its own. However, at the end of the issue, last page, you get a next issue, and it has this picture, and they do reference things that are currently happening in the regular title. So I almost feel like Zdarsky just treated this as like sort of another issue of the regular series, and he just took advantage of it being bigger because it's an annual and he gets more pages to use it to kind of tell the story of Mike Murdock. And he, again, it gives you everything you need to know in this issue, because I'm not fully caught up on Daredevil. I've read the last couple issues. I do know what's going on. So I don't know. It seems like what the things that Zdarsky is doing in Daredevil are interesting, if not wholly original. So I did like the issue overall. And I as far as the art goes, I liked the flashback art better. The Chris Mooneyham art it just has a real style to it. I almost want to say a little bit of John Romita Jr. went, like, before he went off the rails and started drawing everybody as like Lego people, all blocky. There's just a little bit of texture in there and a little bit of blockiness, but not like off the edge. Didn't go off the cliff with blockiness the way Romita's does. So I did enjoy the issue quite a bit. And there's much like Wonder Woman, much like Fantastic Four Antithesis, we get a reveal here on the last page that's one of those, oh, okay. It's actually the very last panel, very last word balloon, we get something where you're like, oh, okay, I see where he's going. This could be pretty interesting. So I would definitely say don't read this book if you haven't read Daredevil 21, because I think they reference it about four times where you see the little box with the asterisk that says, see Daredevil 21. So definitely make sure you've read at least Daredevil 21 going into this. You'll get a lot more out of this than you would otherwise. So all in all, solid issue. Still not sure if I'm a Zdarsky fan, but I need to get caught up. I need to start with issue one of his run of Daredevil and get caught up, and then kind of take another look at his work and see if I'm a fan. I did just recently finally read from start to finish Spider-Man Life Story. That's the 6-issue miniseries by Zdarsky about Spider-Man where he ages in real time. So the first issue takes place in the 60s, the second one takes place in the 70s, third takes place in the 80s, and so on and so forth up to present time. So we're gonna have to do a spotlight on that at some point, because I have thoughts about that. I have thoughts. That's all I'll say. So all right, what do you have up next, Manny?
I have Red Hood Outlaw, or did they change it back to Red Hood and the Outlaws?
No, I think it's still Red Hood Outlaw.
Okay, it is Red Hood Outlaw still. All right, it's just listed still from issue one when it was Red Hood and the Outlaws on the list that I have. Red Hood Outlaws issue 48, and this is written by Scott Liddell, art by Brett Booth, inks by Danny Mickey, colored by Arif Prianto. Can we first give a shout out to Scott Liddell for surviving this long? Because he's been on this title since issue one of Rebirth, and now through Joker War 2020, Scott Liddell is still writing Red Hood Outlaw. And you know what? I think that's incredible. This has been one of my favorite books just because of its consistency. And so it just makes me really happy that there's although it's had different artists and whatnot, but you know, overall the core of the book has been the same. And you've had some of the characters coming in and out. Artemis, Bizarro, Superman, Arsenal was in a couple of issues, and we know how that happened. We know what happened there. So just really cool. I just wanted to take a moment to appreciate that. You know, if it ain't broken, why fix it? So this is going to be a tie-in with Joker War. This one's called An Untold Tale of the Red Hood. And then in parentheses, just in time for the Joker War crossover. And so we find Jason Todd, or Red Hood, whatever you want to call him, in Gotham fighting clowns, just like everybody else is doing in every one of their issues. And so he's actually going to go toe to toe with what's her name, Punchline, and because although it feels like a chess match the way that the Joker is treating the Red Hood, he thinks he has the upper hand. Joker watching him and Punchline and whatever. It makes for a very, very interesting issue. I don't want to give too much away, but I do have a question for you, Jace, because it's on the cover, so it's not really a spoiler. When the hell did Nightwing get brainwashed?
Don't you remember when he didn't get brainwashed, but he lost his memories when he got shot in the head by KG Beast.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, what the hell is going on? Because I don't know how to read Nightwing. So I do remember reading about that, you know, he got shot, but I don't really read Nightwing. So that's that was a little bit of a surprise. It has some flashbacks to when Red Hood or Jason was first brought into the orphanage, that orphanage that is so critical in this run. I think it's popped up many times for many different reasons. After shutting it down, he steps into it one more time in this issue. You get to see him and Bruce in a different light. I thought that was really nice. Usually you see Bruce really always brooding. It was really nice to see him in a different light. I also really appreciate the way that those flashbacks pages are colored, where it's just black, white, and red. I really like that. And then, man, the Red Booth art in this book, I mean, in most books, in all books, whatever you want to call it, it's just ridiculous. There's an action sequence where he's obviously fighting clowns, like I said, but I looked at that page probably for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, just because there was so much going on. It's a splash page, two pages wide. And there's like one scene that encompasses both pages, and then there's like another scene on top of it, and then miniature ones underneath it, and it's just all action and just clowns getting beat left and right by Red Hood. And I thought that it was done so well. It got me like pumped up and excited. I love Batman and his no gun policy, but man, when Red Hood shows up and he uses his quote unquote rubber bullets that even at point blank don't kill anyone, right? It's just so cool to see. It's so different than the rest of the Bat family. I really enjoy almost a Punisher like quality of him, but with more of a Nightwing vibe to him. And so I think that's probably why I like the character so much, and I'm excited to see him in the video game next year, because I get to, as a member of the Bat family, I get to shoot somebody. I appreciate kind of these like really grim looks that they give the clowns in the eyes, even though they're wearing masks. You can tell that they have really bad intentions. And so, just really, really solid issue, I think. I think it's messed up the way that Punchline tries to get at him, but, you know, same thing's happening over at Batman with the Mask of Zorro and trying to pull up things from the past to to win this quote unquote Joker War. Solid issue, really fun to look at, colored amazingly. Definitely recommend it. Even if you haven't been reading Red Hood, but you've been reading Joker War, it's a good tie-in issue that you don't really need to know too much about what happened before. But you after reading this, you may get curious about more about Red Hood's past, and I suggest this run. It's a solid run. Yeah, I think that's it. That's all I got to say about it.
Yeah, I kind of wondered about why they got Danny Mickey to ink Brett Booth instead of Norm. You know, mm-hmm. Norm is Brett's. So the art has a different feel than, you know, like when I think in most recent times of, you know, a long run of Brett Booth art with Norm Ratman on inks, I always go back to The Flash. You know, that was
right. Like, I was gonna say, isn't he on Flash though?
Yeah, that was on. I don't know. Norm's not inking. I don't. I mean, the last thing I know that Norm inked is he inked the that Wally West miniseries, Flash right. Forward, that Brett did okay. the art for. So I'm not sure why. I don't know why Norm didn't ink this, but I think it's okay because, like I said, like you look at that Flash stuff or you look at the Flash Forward stuff, and it gives. Norm's inks give Brett's art a very slick feel. Mm. And this, with Danny Mickey inking him, it's a little more gritty and a little more visceral. And considering the story that's being told, it kind of suits it.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't think anybody inks Brett better than Norm Ratman. So it would have been interesting. The whole issue would have had a different feel if you had Norm ink it. So I don't know if Norm would have been the right choice here, but I wish I had a completed issue with Norm making it and a completed issue as it was done to compare side by side.
It's a lot to ask, man.
No, it would never happen. Why would they pay, you know, the same inker twice or a different inker twice for the same work? But it would just be interesting just because it goes to show how much an inker can have effect on tone of the story. I know not enough.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Not enough inkers get credit for what they do, and people don't really understand what they do. I think it's just tracing and things like that. But this is a perfect example of how a different inkers can affect the final product. All right. Well, I'm going to talk about another DC book next. Also, it's what number is this? Batman Superman number 11, I think. Yep, number 11. It's written by Joshua Williamson. We have art by Clayton Henry, colors are by Alejandro Sanchez, and letters are by John J. Hill. This is the conclusion of the Atomic storyline, which has seen Bruce and Clark, Batman and Superman, fighting against Ultra Humanite. For those that aren't familiar with Ultra Humanite, it's basically this guy from way back when who was like a super evil mad scientist genius, but his body was really frail and weak. So he transplanted his brain into the body of a giant white gorilla. And he's got mental power. His brain is so advanced, he's got like mental powers. Some minor telepathy, but he has telekinesis. And then he's like super strong because of his gorilla body. So like I said, end of the story. And it plays out pretty well. I think one of the things I like most about this book, the reason I read it, is I just like seeing the interaction between Batman and Superman. I think Williamson does a great job with that. We haven't gotten, at least so far yet, we haven't gotten too far into the characterization of the two main characters. I don't feel like Williamson has really delved into either one of them very deeply, but he is starting to explore the relationship between the two, how they feel about each other, why they tell each other certain things, or when they don't tell each other certain things, and the ramifications that has. So that's what this book is really all about. When you talk about Batman versus Superman, everything else in my mind is incidental to that. You know, whatever big bad they're fighting, or you know, whatever else is going on in the plot, it all is there to kind of serve the story about how these two legendary heroes interact with each other. So I think that's where the book really shines. That's the strength of it. The art by Clayton Henry, you know, it's the same as I said last time when I reviewed issue 10. I like the art. Clayton's artwork is a little stylized, and sometimes he draws Superman with the giant horse face. I don't know why he does that sometimes, or his face is just so long. But for the most part, it's classic superhero art. The colors, very primary. So again, it suits the book very well. It gives it that classic superheroic feel. The way the long-running fight that they've had over these, I think it's five issues, maybe six, that's been going on with Ultra Humanite, it makes total sense. You sort of kind of see it coming if you're, you know, a longtime comic reader, but it's still cool when it happens. And the visuals and the things that Ultra Humanite is doing, they all make a lot of sense. We get to see a little bit of Superman being a detective instead of just Batman being a detective. So that was cool as well. So a lot of great moments in here from kind of just a straight up action and superhero comic kind of perspective. But like I said, where the book really shines is after the battle's over, after the battle's won, and we get Superman and Batman in the Batcave sort of debriefing, you know, sort of unwinding and talking about the case. That's my favorite, you know, few moments in the whole book. So, yeah, really great issue. I don't know what the future holds for Joshua Williamson. I know that he's got an arc on Justice League starting up that ties in with Dark Knight Death Metal that runs five issues. And I know his Flash is coming to an end. And after that, I don't know. So I hope that he's staying on Batman, Superman, and I hope he's going on something classic, because, you know, much like Libdell on Red Hood, where some people are upset that he's been on it that long because of his, you know, I'm not going to get into it here, but he's been accused of inappropriate behavior with creators before, and a lot of people think that the only reason he was able to stay as long as he did was, much like Eddie Braganza, Bob Harris was protecting Libdell. So I don't know the truth of that or not, but we know Libdell's run is coming to an end, and the whole Red Hood title is coming to an end, and Flash we know is not coming to an end, but Joshua Williamson is moving on from that title. So there's not a lot of writers left who are still on the book that they launched with Rebirth, and I think, in fact, those may be the last two. I can't think of anybody else. So, I mean, Tom King should have still been on Batman, but they kicked him off, and he's finishing up in Bat and Cat. So, I don't know. We'll see what the future holds for Joshua Williamson. What do you have up next, Manny?
Up next, I have Detective Comics. 1026.
Yep.
I don't even know what the hell to call it anymore. anywho, this is another single issue that is kind of tied into Joker War. It's called Monsters of Men, and this is by Peter J. Tomasi, artwork by Kenneth Rockfort, colors by Daniel Brown. And dude, I gotta say, I felt like this issue was kind of phoned in. Just overall, I know that 1027 is a milestone issue because it's the anniversary of Batman and Detective Comics, but it just really, I don't know, it does tie into the Joker War. It gives us a little bit more humanity to Killer Croc. But just overall, it's just about a bunch of people trying to get away from Joker War in a nutshell. And I just didn't really feel like it was that important. But I get it. You know, next issue is a milestone issue, and then after that you can probably start your next run in October, I guess. So for me it's not that important. If you don't read it, you don't really, unless you're like a fan of Killer Croc, I don't really, which would be interesting. Like, I if there's somebody who's like, yeah, Killer Croc's my favorite Batman villain, I want to have a conversation as to why, just curiosity.
Yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of people, and they've said this about Tomasi before, just let Tomasi be Tomasi and just let Tomasi write the kind of stories he likes to write, because if you read the rest of his Detective Comics run, you can read it totally standalone. You don't need to read anything else that's going on in the DC universe, and that's what makes what him and Brad Walker have been doing on Detective feels like so classic mm-hmm. and timeless, because you don't have to read anything else to read it, and you almost think, okay, well, because Joker War is so big and Detective is like the big second biggest Batman title, you have to acknowledge Joker War is happening. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, not to say that Tomasi would ever phone it in, but because of editorial instructions, if you will, he's being told, okay, you've got to write some Joker War stories, when that's really not what he wants to do, you know? And so it's not that he's phoning it in, but he's just, these are kind of filler issues, kind of the definition or a poster boy of what a filler issue is going to be. And then you're right, then we get Detective Comics, you know, 1027 next month, and then after that, hopefully Tomasi and Brad Walker can go back to telling, you know, Batman stories the way they want to, instead of trying to tie in with these big events that are going on and what have you.
Right, and that's, it just sucks because it's, you get used to Detective being so good, and then it's like, oh god, all right, they have to acknowledge Joker War, but that's happening, and I guess happening in all the books. Like Batwoman, yeah. So you just got Red Hood is another perfect example. You just have to deal with it, but you further back it up into a corner because of the 1027 next month. So in a way, it was kind of annoying. It's like, oh, all right, so I really have to wait till kind of October to really get whatever the next story arc is going to be, which is great in October, but for now, like if this was a book that I had picked up today, then I'd be very disappointed.
Yeah, well, so I was gonna say, I wonder, then we get into October for 1028, and it's a tie-in for Death Metal.
God damn.
No, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. You should probably look that up right now while I talk about my next book, because now I'm curious if that's the case. Detective 1028 ties into Death Metal, and we still don't get Tomasi telling the story that he wants to tell.
Find out.
All right, well, let me talk about my last book, and then Manny will talk about his last book, which is probably going to be both of our books of the week, is my guess. So my last book is Flash number 760, also written by Joshua Williamson, as I was talking about before. We have a couple different artists. We have Christian Duce and Scott Collins on art, so pencils and inks, and then Luis Guerrero and Hi-Fi handle the colors for those respective artists, with Luis Guerrero coloring Christian Duce's pages and Hi-Fi coloring Scott Collins' pages. And then we've got Steve Wands on letters. So this is, as I was saying before, Joshua Williamson's swan song on The Flash. So he's been on it for a long, long time, and he's basically wrapping up all his storylines with this final story that he's telling called Finish Line. So this is part two. In part one, and spoilers for part one, if you haven't seen it, I'm going to give something away right now. So if you plan on reading it, skip forward about 10 seconds. In Finish Line part one, we saw Reverse Flash take over Flash's body. And Flash gets sent into a part of the Speed Force that's called the Starting Line. So it kind of ties into that Finish Line title of the last arc. So what I love about this final Flash story that Joshua Williamson is telling is that he's going all in terms of, we're getting to see all the Flash family. We're getting to see some old friends come back that we haven't seen since, as far as I know, since before the Flashpoint event. So that's really great. You know, we're seeing Jay Garrick. We're seeing a lot of the Rogues. We're seeing the Kid Flashes. So it's great to see Williamson pulling out all the stops and sort of celebrating one of the things that in recent years people have loved so much about the Flash, and that's the Flash family. One thing we haven't seen is Wally, Wally West, that is. And I don't know if we are going to see him based on, you know, what happened in Flash Forward and based on what's happening in Dark Knight's Death Metal right now. But I kind of think we will, but I'm just not sure. So I can't really talk too much more about what happens in the story without giving anything away, other than this does feel like it's going to tie up so much of what's been going on in the Flash for the past like 3 years, and whoever comes on the Flash after this, it's going to be somewhat of a clean slate. Like, they could kind of do anything. They could go in any direction they want. I know what the direction a lot of people would want to see is Wally West come back as the Flash, and that's even a possibility. I don't, you know, see anything in this issue that would make me think that they would go in that direction. But they, like I said, they could, because they really are tying up so much. So I got to think that Joshua Williamson is having a blast writing this, or had a blast writing this last arc, because, like I said, every member of the Flash family is showing up, and just about every rogue makes an appearance as well. So I'm expecting a big brawl in the next issue. So really enjoyed it. And of the artists, I kind of liked the art by Christian Ducé. I know I've talked in the past about him being better suited to be a cover artist. I think this issue shows growth to me on his sequentials. His panel-to-panel transitions and such are getting better. His storytelling is getting better. So I definitely see an improvement. And his style is cleaner than Scott Collins, who's been, you know, doing this for a long time. And Collins is definitely a classic Flash artist. But I almost enjoyed the line work and the colors. Or not almost, I did. I enjoyed the line work and the colors on Ducey with Luis Guerrero colors more than I did Scott Collins with Hi-Fi. Again, it's just a preference in style. Ducey's style is much cleaner lines, whereas Scott Collins is much more of a kind of a sketchy style. So that's just a personal preference. The art and the storytelling that Collins gives us here is as good as anything, you know, that Collins has ever done. His artwork's very kinetic and shows a lot of movement, which is why he's been a go-to Flash artist for so long. So if you haven't been reading Flash, because I know some people have talked about, they think Williamson drags things out too much and it's kind of boring, man, go pick up part one of Finish Line and pick up this part two that's on stands today. Read this last arc, because it's been a lot of action so far, and I expect that to continue. I think this last arc, as Williamson finishes up, he's throwing in everything and the kitchen sink here, because he knows this is kind of his last hurrah on the Flash for now. So if he dropped it because he thought it was boring or slow paced, it's not that anymore. It's fast paced, tons of characters, a lot going on. And I definitely recommend it. If it wasn't for the other book that Manny is going to talk about next, this would have been my book of the week, because just based on how many characters we're seeing and how fast paced and how much action we're seeing. So, all right, Manny, it's the one everybody's been waiting for. What's your last book?
My last book is Batman: Three Jokers. Dun, number dun, dun. One, written by Jeff Johns, with artwork by Jason Fabok, colors by Brad Anderson. I don't know what to tell you, man. The artwork on this book is just phenomenal. It might have to do with it, so, you know, it's my favorite artist on it. All right, in all seriousness, it's a book we've been waiting for, 3 years now? And so finally, 5 years?
It's been 5 years, bro.
Jesus Christ.
Remember we talked about, I don't know if we talked about it on a podcast, but we talked about the fact that when Batman sat on the Mobius chair, issue came out in like, it was like the June or July issue of Justice League, like, in 2015. So over, technically over 5 years since we learned there were three Jokers.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
well, I mean, okay, so to be fair, we did learn that there, but we didn't know that we were going to get that title until post Rebirth.
Yeah.
But I mean, okay, so the way this book starts, I thought was fantastic. With Batman coming in, and Alfred having to stitch him up, but the way that from panel to panel, we don't have any words. We just have his scars, and kind of like just the stories that those scars tell, I thought was fantastic. It really sets up. It really introduces the book to what it makes it look like is the character that has given him the most scars, the Joker, and. From there, I just don't know how much I can talk about it because I have quite a bit of problems with this book. It's still my book of the week, and I know it's issue one, so I have to give it more than one issue to really give it a final grade, but. For as long as we waited for it and for what we got in this first issue, if I'm being completely honest, this book was a little bit underwhelming. Because the mystery is set up well, but the execution of what happens throughout the issue after that, I almost felt like I had missed something. It's really quick, and I'm just trying to refrain myself from saying something I shouldn't, but I'm really interested to see what the next issue brings, where they go from here, but it's just I'm not sure what I'm looking for. Unorganized, maybe. I'm not sure. It's just not. I mean, I'm not sure what I was expecting, really. But I wasn't expecting that kind of a reveal or that kind of meeting that soon. And it was strange.
Yeah,
I didn't like it as much as I thought as much as I wanted to.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. It's my book of the week. Fabox art is phenomenal. I didn't realize how much I missed his art. You know, we haven't had him on sequentials in such a long time because he's just been
real quick. His Batman kicking in the door of an ambulance. So good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean the whole thing.
Yeah, well, yeah.
The way he kind of reminds me a little bit of Lee Bermejo in the way he adds little details to the costume and the way he kind of makes things a little bit realistic, but he takes it much more, his stuff's much more superheroic. Lee's stuff is much more like if this person existed in real life. Like,
yeah, grounded. Yeah, I can see that.
They would look like kind of like Alex Ross is, right? Mm-hmm. If this person was a real person, this is what they would actually look like. Fabox stuff, it always looks comic booky, but the best things about comic book art and detailed and great line work and yeah, super, super awesome. So loved everything about that. Kind of like you, I guess part of the reason I was underwhelmed is because it has been 5 years. And the other thing that I want to point out is, so when we first heard that there are three Jokers is when during the Darkseid War, mm-hmm. Batman sits on the Mobius chair. Like this yes. giant event, this Darkseid War event, is where the concept of the three Jokers first hear about it, we first learn of it. So the whole idea to me is that this story spun out of this big cosmic event. So I was kind of expecting And again, part of it is my expectations I'm bringing to it, and the fact it took them 5 years to do. Well, if it took them 5 years, it must be this big, expansive story. And I read the first issue, and while it's technically good, dialogue's great. You know, I mean, technically nothing wrong with the issue, from the art to the pacing, the dialogue from John's, you know, it's just everything. It's technically a very, very good comic. I can't complain about any of it. But then when I look at the plot, I'm like, wait, this is only three issues, right? So you're telling me this was a third of this great big story I've been waiting for 5 years? Because it sure didn't feel like a third of a big giant story. It felt like a third of a, you know, random Batman limited series. You know what I mean? Like Thrill Killer from, you know, Dan Brereton. It's a great book, you know. Don't get me wrong. Art's great. Wonderful story. You know, Elseworlds, Batman in the 60s. You know, mod kind of thing or whatever. That whole groovy thing. And it's great. But I didn't wait 5 years for it, and it wasn't built up in my mind, and it just kind of exists, and it is what it is, and it's fine. This has been built up to be like this great thing that, you know, is supposed to, like, I don't know, change the Joker forever or some kind of thing. I don't know. So, I mean, there's three Jokers. It's like I should be getting some information.
Right, yeah.
After reading the first issue, I have more questions about how there are three separate and distinct Jokers than I did before the issue started. Like, huh? So, I feel like I guess it's going to be one of those series where I'm not going to be able to give it a true grade until I read the whole thing.
That's a little frustrating, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm like, well, maybe it needed to be, maybe it should have been more, maybe it should have been six issues. But then I think
it feels like it, yeah.
Yeah, but then we'd be waiting another 5 years.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I don't know. Maybe the pacing is going to pick up. Maybe they're going to cram more into the next issue or the next couple issues.
Cram more than they did in this issue?
Well, you know, you did mention that the first couple pages there we got, and I thought they were cool. I thought they were, you know, great art, powerful images, where Batman is showing off his scars and you're seeing how he got those particular scars. There's no really any dialogue on those pages. It's still storytelling, but there's no dialogue. So if you know, in the next issue, assuming you have the same amount of panels, but fill that with actual story, flashback, or, you know, how the three Jokers met, what their origin, you know, something, we could get more, a little more. There's not a whole lot of room, but we could get a little more. So I don't know. I don't know what to think, which in a way, maybe that's a good thing, right? I mean, so many comics we read now, we see the ending coming from a mile away. This certainly isn't that. I'm not sure what the heck we're going to do. Where are we going to go? Somebody told me that after reading it, they thought that maybe this was the last Joker story. They're asking, is this in continuity? Because I heard all the Jokers were going to die. And I said, so I heard it wasn't going to be in continuity at first.
I mean, like,
first it was going to be in continuity. Like, you know, Batman, one of the Mobius chair, find that three Jokers, so it was going to be in continuity. And then they said, no, we're going to make it a Black Label book. And we know the Black Label books aren't necessarily in continuity. So first it was going to be in continuity, then it wasn't going to be in continuity. Then Dan Didio got fired, and who knows, and now we've heard that the two editors in charge of Black Label are going to be laid off at the end of the year. So who knows if there's even going to be a Black Label going forward. This book will still come out under the Black Label imprint, but going forward, we don't know. So the last thing I heard is somebody at DC said, it can be in continuity if you want, but if you don't want it to be in continuity, then it doesn't have to be. I'm like, wait, how does that make sense? And then my other thought was, well, if they really are going to kill the Jokers, like all three of these Jokers, then I'd be all in for it. Like, if they're really killing them for good, I'd be all in for this to be in
for at least 5 years.
Because then, you know, we wouldn't get any Joker. I wouldn't, please. Yeah. 5 years. We'd be lucky if we went 12 months. But we could at least
go 6 months.
We could at least go, you know, a month or two without a Joker in somewhere. I would be fine with that. But the other thing I think is, if they do that, if they were to kill all these Jokers, then I have a feeling that they would do it in such a way that we find out that the Joker isn't really one person. You know, it's the Joker's like, when one Joker dies, then like the spirit of the Joker or whatever it is passed on to somebody else. Somebody else becomes the Joker. It's like a,
I would hate that.
like a totem power thing, you know, like there's always a Joker, you know, and then the instant one of them dies, it's that the Jokerness is passed on to somebody else.
Oh God, that's terrible.
Yeah. That could be why we're seeing, you know, three different, maybe something happened where the spirit of the Jokers got split and it didn't go into just one person. It went into three. I don't know. I'm just speculating. That I could see them doing something like that if they want to kill all three Jokers, but still be able to bring them back in a couple months.
So I think one of my other issues with this book is that there's a lot of Batman stories or ideas that I feel like have been beaten, like just beaten over and over again in every story, and I'm given like all of them in one issue. And I'm like, oh my God, like I get it. Like these are parts of the characters and everything, but Jesus Christ, like
Batman's your favorite character, bro. Way hating.
I know, but I'd rather explain this to you off because I don't want to give away too much of the issue, but there's just ideas that are just like it's exhausting. Why is it? Well, because Batman's their cash cow, and so we're just gonna keep pumping out Batman stories and Joker stories because Joker sells too. So hang in there; we're gonna get more Joker stories. So,
yep.
I don't know.
And all that being said, we still chose this. We still both chose this as our book of the week. If you only buy one comic this week, it probably needs to be this. And I'm picking it based on the power and the excellent artwork, the potential of the story. I'm going to say it like this: the potential of the story,
yes,
and the incredible execution.
There could be a major payoff. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, and the incredible execution by Jason Fabok, art wise.
Yeah, if you're gonna get a cover, also get this one. Get the one with the fish.
Get the one.
That one is so fucking cool.
Yeah, I really like the purple and green one, but that's the incentive one, and I'm not paying like $22. So my plan is, I only ordered like the regular cover because I wasn't sure what I wanted, and so I'm planning hopefully to get to my comic shop super early tomorrow, like right when they open, and I'm just gonna grab whatever they have. I don't know. I'll probably get the fish cover.
It was really cool
because I already have, you know, already, like I said, I already have the Crowbar cover coming from DCBS, so I'll probably buy one other cover, and that'll probably be the fish. So just to have a second one.
I should pick up your card.
What's that?
Oh, you got a card also when you pick up the books.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, I forgot about that. A Joker playing card, yeah, we'll see. My LCF should have those. So, all right, well, let's give a rundown on some of the other books you might want to be on the lookout for. Coming out tomorrow from Aftershock, we've got God Killers number 5 and The Man Who Effed Up Time number 5. Those are the final issues of those two series. From Ahoy Comics, we have Billionaire Island number 5 of 4. And I'm not sure how that works if it was supposed to be only 4 issues. And issue 5 of 4 is coming out tomorrow. So, yeah, not sure about that. From Boom Studios, we've got Mega Man Fully Charged number 1, as well as Mighty Morphin Power Rangers number 53. I think that's the final issue of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Do you know if that's true, Manny? I know they're...
I do not.
Yeah, I know they're bringing the Power Ranger titles to a close, only to relaunch them the following month. So, but I think that's the final issue. I'm not 100% on that. And we also have Wind number 3 of 5, which has been a really hot book from Boom by James Tynan. Over at DC, in addition to the books we talked about, Action Comics number 1024 is out tomorrow. Books of Magic number 22. Dark Knight's Death Metal number 2 and number 3 second printings are out. So if you missed those the first time around, you can grab them. Legion of Superheroes number 8 comes out, as well as another Black Label book, Question the Deaths of Vic Sage number 4, with art by Dennis Cohen. I believe that one's written by Jeff Lemire. So I have all the issues. I just haven't read any of them yet. Over at IDW, we already talked about Canto number 2, but I also wanted to mention Lock and Key in Pale Battalions Go number 1. So a new Lock and Key series is starting. So if you're into Lock and Key, definitely check that out. Also, the latest issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is number 108. From Image Comics, we have The Return of Black Magic with issue number 13. That's been I feel like it's been a year or maybe over a year since Black Magic has been on stands. Written by Greg Rucka with art by the incredible Nicola Scott. So definitely pick that up if you get the chance. Also, Spawn number 309 is out tomorrow. That introduces a new Spawn character, and I hear speculation's already going crazy on this book, so you might have a hard time tracking that down if you don't get to your comic book store early. I think it's already selling for over cover online, but it's introducing a gunslinger Spawn, like an old West version of Spawn. So I guess all the speculators are out in force on that book, and I don't think any of them care to read it, which kind of just bugs me when speculators. One of my retailer friends was talking about it tonight. People calling his shop asking for it today. He's like, it's not on sale yet. And no, we don't have any extra copies. But can I help you with something? Click. And they just hang up. So over at Marvel, Amazing Spider-Man number 47. A couple of Empire books, Empire Avengers number 3 and Empire Captain America number 3. Over in the X-Men corner of the universe, we have Hellions number 3. X-Factor number 2 and X-Men number 11. We have Iron Man 2020 number 6, which brings that miniseries to a close. We've got Spider-Man Noir number 3. In the Star Wars corner of the Marvel Universe, we have Star Wars Dr. Aphra number 3. And then the last thing that I will mention is from Valiant, we have Doctor Tomorrow number 5 of 5. So pretty big week, especially for being the last Monday of or last Wednesday rather of the month. Usually the last Wednesday of the month are a little bit lighter, but man, we got a ton of books that are coming out. A lot of books from DC, a lot of books from Marvel, and some great independents as well. So that's going to do it for this episode. Just a reminder that Manny and I both picked Batman Three Jokers as our book of the week, despite some misgivings. The quality of the art and the potential of the story, the potential of the impact of the story had us choosing it. So as always, I want to thank everybody for joining, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.